Final hour of overtime here on the Fan, taking you up until 10 o'clock. Toby Altizer with you. 800-636-1067 if you'd like to hop in. I want to get to a strange baseball injury that we saw pop up. We'll get to that in just a little bit. But first, I want to play a clip from Jalen Hurts for you. So earlier today, Eagles were at OTAs as well. And normally, Chris, I would not be playing Jalen Hurts audio because I can't stand listening to him speak in his cliches. And he did, you know, a little bit of that afterwards, but it was hilarious. He gets asked a question about A.J. Brown as he's going for a sip of his water. And I thought his response was perfect. So here was Jalen Hurts at the podium earlier today for Eagles OTAs.
If A.J. is traded, how would that affect the offense? How would that affect you?
Pick the right question to sip on, huh? No, I think for us, you know, we're focused on learning the offense. It really doesn't change in terms of our approach to improve. You know, there's an if. Obviously been a lingering thing, but, you know, none can replace all the greatness that we achieved together.
I mean, that's a cool way to describe it at the end there, and I'm curious which side of the who all that beef is coming from, but I love the response of, well, picked the right time to take a sip of my water, didn't I? I thought that was pretty good from Jalen Hurts, but that's a whole interesting discussion that I'm curious how that's all going to play out. I mean, at some point it has to play out. We're inching up on June 1st when most people are thinking that that trade could get done because of the cap ramifications. So could A.J. Brown end up in New England playing with Drake May, and that's kind of their replacement for Stephon Diggs? And, you know, the Eagles brought in Mekhi Lemon. They drafted Eli Stowers as well, and that's kind of what they're going to rock with in their receiving core, and Stowers as an extra tight end threat as a receiver. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. It's kind of a, you don't want to say prove it season for the Eagles after, you know, it seems like every other year they go to the Super Bowl, they fire or lose their offensive coordinator basically after every season. And something that slept on a little bit, I also saw that Saquon said that he had reached out to Todd Gurley about being a running back in a style of scheme similar to McVay. So you're going to have another scheme in the NFC East that kind of branches off of that Shanahan style scheme similar to David Blough when they brought over Sean Mannion. But I was not a fan of the David Blough hire overall. I think I've made that pretty clear, and I'm hoping that he does well, and I think Blough seems like a really bright individual, and I hope it goes well. So I'm just a little skeptical, more so than, you know, not believing in David Blough overall, just a little skeptical on a first-time play caller guy going into his third season as a coach being handed the reins in a do-or-die season. But the Eagles did something almost the exact same, but I think, in my view, even worse. So at least with David Blough, he's been in this building for the last two seasons and got promoted. So he's been working with Jaden Daniels for the last 2 years. He's been working with Terry McLaurin the last 2 years. He worked with Bill last season. He worked with that offensive line last season. He's worked with these guys in this building for the last couple of seasons, and now he has just stepped up to the front of the room, and he's the guy in charge. He's the one drawing up the plays. He's the one calling the plays. So at least you have a guy that's very familiar with everything that's going on in that building, very familiar with everybody that he's going to be working with to build that offense. Sean Mannion comes over from the Green Bay Packers to the Philadelphia Eagles, and you can't say the same thing about that familiarity. So you're starting from page one with all of these guys. You don't know Jalen Hurts. You don't know A.J. Brown, who's probably not going to be there. You don't know Devontae Smith. Obviously, like some of the rookies and stuff they brought in, you don't know Saquon Barkley, right? You don't know all those guys. You haven't worked with them. And now you're building your offense with a bunch of guys that you haven't worked with. And maybe that can be a good thing to an extent because you're building an offense that you hope can work with just about anybody. And then you can tailor it to your guys a little bit. But I think if you were giving me the option, when you're going with a young coordinator who's unproven, who's having to build his playbook, give me one where they have been in the building working with the specific guys that they're building the system for, that they have a real understanding of what's going on versus bringing somebody in from outside the organization to take over and run this thing. But, I mean, you go into the season and Nick Sirianni has to be on the hot seat. I mean, I know Eagles fans that can't stand Nick Sirianni, even though he's had the success that he's had. And you look at their receiving options, and they've still got some really good players, but A.J. Brown was a really good weapon to have on the outside. He provides a lot for you. Devontae Smith isn't that big, intimidating factor on the outside. Mekhi Lemon's more of a slot guy. Dontavian Wicks is someone they brought over from Green Bay. I guess he wasn't at OTAs, but he's someone that has a body type that's more along what A.J. Brown's is, but he's not nearly that type of receiver. So you're looking at their receiving weapons, and they're not as good. Jalen Hurts, I think this is a big season for him. He's a funny quarterback. He really is. I think sometimes when you throw him at the top of these lists, he's a little bit overrated. And then sometimes the way people talk about him, it's almost as if he's a guy that doesn't understand how to play the quarterback position, a guy that hasn't won a Super Bowl, a guy that hasn't gone toe-to-toe with Patrick Mahomes in the playoffs and been better than him both times they've faced off, even the Super Bowl that they lost to them. It's really, really weird the way that that goes for him, but I don't know that he's, you know, a top 12 quarterback in the league, but at the same point, I've seen him in the playoffs play like he's a top 5 quarterback in the league. So he's an interesting factor in all of this, and I wonder if some of the stuff just hasn't gone stale there in Philadelphia, but they're a funny organization. Every single time it feels like the drama picks up, it feels like they play better football or something of that nature. It's just really weird how much stuff goes on in that building, and then they just turn out a really good football team, and their defense is going to be good again, you know, to have all those guys. Jahad Campbell, I think, is going to be better in year two for them. Jalen Carter's obviously a beast, but they added Reek Woolen to a secondary that already had Quinyon Mitchell and Cooper DeJean. I mean, it's going to be a really, really good team once again, and I think that's who you're fighting at the top of the NFC East. I mean, when you look at the division, I would think that it's the Eagles at the top. I think the Cowboys are kind of the middle, and the Giants are at the bottom, and the Commanders got to figure out where they're trying to slot themselves in at. You would hope that they're up there fighting with the Eagles, but the way that they played last season, you're more so fighting with the Giants and less so the Cowboys. So that's going to be interesting to see how this season plays out, and the crazy part about this schedule for the Commanders is you're going to get answers about where you stand in the division very, very quickly. Last year, you had to wait a while to play a significant amount of division games. This time around, Philly to start, Dallas, then you've got New York in week 5, then you've come off your bye week, and you've got Philly for the second time in week 8. That's 4 of your 6 division games played in the first 8 weeks, and then 5 of your first 10 weeks are division games with the Giants second time in week 10, and then you finally play Dallas again in week 18. So it's going to be really, really pivotal for this team to come out of the gates hot, because if you don't, losing to Philly and Dallas, well, that's okay, 0-2, that's fine, but it's 0-2 in the division as well, and that's going to be massive. And then you're going into another conference opponent against Seattle. So you've got to come out of the gates hot. You've got to come out with some more intensity. You've got to make sure that you're ready to roll coming onto the field at 4:25 on the 13th at Lincoln Financial Field, or I can guarantee you Philly's going to be ready to roll. If you're not ready to roll, they'll boat race you like they did in the NFC Championship game. All right, I want to get into a little baseball. How about this? A strange injury. Baseball leads all sports in this, I feel like. I feel like I don't see these weird injuries all that often from football players. I don't feel like I see it all that often from basketball players, but you see it from baseball players all the time. And maybe it's made-up stories to cover up things. Who knows? I can tell you this one, you can at least see the film of this one. You can see the footage of this one. A strange injury, not in Major League Baseball, in Minor League Baseball. We'll get into that next and take a look at some of the craziest injury stories that we've had throughout baseball history. Also want to talk about James Wood before we get out of here, how special he's been. Let's talk about strange baseball injuries next. You're listening to Overtime on the Fan. Overtime on the Fan, taking you up until 10 o'clock. I want to talk about James Wood in a couple minutes. But first, I want to start with some crazy baseball injuries. Toby Altizer with you here on Overtime. And there was one recently. Have you heard some of the crazy baseball injuries, Chris, throughout history? Metal, like, some of these funny ones? Because we just had one, and hopefully it's nothing serious. We're still trying to figure out what happened to this Dodgers prospect. But looking down memory lane on some of these, have you heard some of the crazy ones?
I don't know. Like, you have to tell me, because I don't know what you haven't said yet. I don't know.
So here's one from on Glenn Allen Hill, who he was having a nightmare about spiders, woke up in a panic, and accidentally crashed through a glass table and then had to have stitches because he cut himself.
Was he like asleep on a couch or something?
I think just he probably at a hotel or whatever and scared himself, hopped up, and fell through the glass table in the darkness and cut himself.
That's wild.
Apparently, Yoenis Cespedes fractured his ankle because he had an encounter with a wild boar.
If he's hunting, then I can kind of see it.
Here's one for you. Marty Cordova had trouble with a tanning bed, fell asleep inside of it, and doctors told him not to see sunlight because he burned his face.
Yeah, that's not something you want to do is fall asleep in a tanning bed. I know that one already.
This one's probably relatable to a lot of gentlemen that are a little bit older. Sammy Sosa strained a ligament in his back on a sneeze.
Come on. That's ridiculous. While he was a player? That happened as a player?
Yeah, as a player. Had to miss time. Ricky Henderson had to miss some games because he fell asleep with his foot being iced and he had frostbite. This one I remember because I was covering the team in Milwaukee, and it sounds like one of the most painful things ever. Rowdy Tellez was out in the outfield. He's a big, hefty dude, so he was just kind of screwing around during BP, and he got his finger stuck in the wall, and when he pulled it out, it like ripped the nail bed off the... He had to have surgery. Small fracture on his finger, and you know how like you get stuck between the padding on the walls and just ripped. Oh, it's terrible.
Ugh.
Sounds so painful. Freddie Freeman slipped in the shower and hurt his ankle that had been put together, had surgery on in the offseason just a couple of years ago during the World Series. Lance McCullers had to have his start pushed back because he got hit by a champagne bottle during a celebration.
That's like some Gus Frerotte level stuff there.
One that's not on here, I remember Trevor Bauer, when the Indians were in the World Series, had to have a start pushed back because he was working on his drone and cut his finger pretty bad. So there are some wacky baseball injuries. Well, we've got a new one here, Chris, and I'll send you the video of this so you can watch it. I want to get your thoughts on it because this is kind of wild, and I bet you Danny Ruye was having a field day after seeing this because he is not a fan of this being a part of the game. I'm just going to read this for you. Tulsa Drillers AA affiliate, the AA affiliate of the Dodgers, are planning to suspend their bat dog after their first-round pick Kendall George suffered a patellar injury jumping out of the way of the bat dog. Like, I feel bad for this dude. This is a guy who's really fast. He's not just a nobody prospect either. He's a good player. Could be someone that helps out this Dodgers team in a couple of years. So what happens is George scores on the play. He hits home plate. He's running towards the dugout. And the bat dog just sprints right out of the dugout to go grab the bat. And he doesn't want to run into the dog, so he hops out of the way and in turn somehow injures his knee. Like, it looks pretty innocent, but this apparently ended up in a pretty significant injury. I'm hoping it's nothing too crazy. They're still trying to find out the details on it. How crazy is this, though? I mean, when they tell you, why'd you go on the shelf, why'd you get hurt, and it's the freaking bat dog, which shouldn't be, I know
sounds
so
like
many
a comic
people...
comic book character, like Batman's dog or something, right? Like...
I know so many people love dogs.
I love dogs.
I think some of the dog love has gone a little bit too far at times. Like, I feel bad for this guy because he gets injured in this play, and the amount of people that are attacking him for this because they're like, oh, the good boy wouldn't do anything. Like, that is ridiculously stupid to me. But there are some things that dogs don't need to be a part of.
Well, I'm sure it's there just make, you know, people go, oh, it's cute or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun thing. It's a fun thing, but now that this has happened, like, all right, maybe don't do this again.
This reminds me of the guy. Wasn't there a guy on the Angels, like, years ago that injured himself jumping on home plate after, like, a grand slam?
Yeah, Kendrys Morales hit a walk-off homer and landed on home plate and broke his leg and was done for the year.
I remember seeing the clip of that. He, like, trotted all up, and, like, the whole team was up there, and they were all excited, and, like, he jumped, and then, like, he didn't get up. You're like, what?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough. I mean, there have been guys that have hurt themselves doing ridiculous things. Obviously,
the thing I was thinking of first, and this is why I was like, I don't know what you're going to bring up, but the Randy Johnson bird.
Well, and luckily that was just the bird that got hurt. That wasn't Randy Johnson.
But also just like a bizarre baseball thing. I don't know. I don't even know what to call
baseball
that.
Stuff. You get some weird stuff that can happen when you play 162 games. You can have some weird things happen, especially when you get to the minor leagues and some of the stuff that they do at minor league ballparks, some of the promotions, some of the things that they do. It is quite funny. But I feel bad for this kid. I mean, he's just playing baseball. He's running back to the dugout after scoring a run, and the dog essentially just darts out of the dugout, and he's just trying to not run into the dog and injures himself. I mean, it sucks. It really sucks. I mean, it's one of those things that...
What kind of
it's
dog
pretty
was
avoidable.
It? Did they say what kind of, like, was it a big breed or something?
No, I mean, I sent you the video if you want to watch it. Okay, it's like it looked like a border collie or something like that. Like, it's nothing crazy. It's Great
like
Dane running out and it's going to run him over. It's also, but it's also not a Chihuahua. It has to be able to pick up a actual baseball bat. So I just feel bad for the guy. I mean, it's one of those things that's so avoidable. Maybe it's like a German Shepherd. I don't know. It's not a big dog. Or not a giant dog, but also not a small dog. So it's just, that's the kind of stuff that only in baseball, but I feel bad for the guy because people are coming after him like, hey man, why don't you grow up?
Oh, and it's it does look like a German Shepherd or something. You're right.
It's like, but it's just crazy to me that so many people are defending the dog.
Well, like the dog wasn't, like the dog wasn't trying to do something mean.
No, it's not like
it's
the dog,
dog
did anything. The dog did nothing wrong. Clearly, it's the humans that put the dog in a bad spot and that put the human in a bad spot. I don't know. I feel bad for Kendall George, regardless. There's another one of your weird baseball injuries where you've got a dog, the bat dog, led to an injury for one of the Dodgers prospects. I can only imagine the headlines if Nationals fans had something like this happen to a Nationals prospect. I can only imagine the headlines. I can only imagine the discourse on Nationals Twitter. Thankfully, that's not the case. And Fred Nats.
Imagine that happened to Dylan Cruz when they sent him down at the beginning of the season.
Don't you put that evil on me. No. Don't you dare. So I'm just asking you, Fredericksburg, Wilmington, Harrisburg, Rochester. No, none of the bat dog gimmick. I'm good on that. Don't be hurting my Gavin Fien or Eli Willits. Like, no. We're good on that. I need Devin Fitzgerald to be fine and two functioning legs. Don't be messing with that. All right, let's talk about the Washington Nationals. Let's talk about James Wood. He's been off to a fantastic start this season. Looks like a budding superstar for the Nationals. Got some love this morning on MLB Central and MLB Network. Let's talk about James Wood next here on The Fan. Welcome back. It's Overtime, 106.7 The Fan. Toby Altizer taking you up until 10 o'clock. We're talking about some weird baseball injuries. I want to continue the talk about baseball. Nationals fell to the Guardians today, but you saw them win 2 of 3 in Cleveland. And one of the stars of the series was James Wood and the two wins for the Nationals. He was 4 for 5 on Monday with a homer, and then he was 3 for 4 with a homer yesterday. Didn't have a homer today, but still was productive for the team once again. And you look at his numbers, he's been fantastic. Today he did have a hit. He was 1 for 3 with a strikeout and a walk. But his numbers overall now, .276 batting average. His OPS up to .967, which is a jump from .825 last year. His on-base percentage has jumped almost 65 points. His slugging percentage has jumped 80 points. And I think the thing that's so impressive about him is, yes, the strikeout numbers are high. He's always going to lead, be one of the top guys in the league in strikeouts, but He's also going to draw his walks, and that's something that's been really impressive to see from him this season. When you look at the number of walks that he has this year, in 57 games this season, he's got 47 walks. Last year in 157 games, he had 85. So he's more than half the way there in almost a third of the games. So it's been impressive to see what he's been able to do there. Homers, he's at 15, 37 runs batted in. Last season had 94 RBIs, 31 homers. And just seeing his improvement year over year is so impressive to see. Last season, he was really, really good in the first half. He kind of struggled a little bit in the second half. But he's one of the best hitters in the sport right now. His batting run value, according to Baseball Savant, is in the 98th percentile at 18. If you just look at his Baseball Savant page, it's all red. The only spots that are not great would be his whiff percentage and strikeout percentage, which, like we said, that's going to come as part of his game. But everything else is red. His average exit velo is 100th percentile, meaning he's tops in the sport at 96.5. His barrel percentage is tops in the sport. Hard hit percentage. Bat speed is 95th percentile. His walk percentage is really, really high. And so to see what he's been able to do at the plate this season, it's funny. We've spent so much time talking about CJ and how much improvement we've seen from him that it's almost expected with James, and it kind of goes under the radar how much he has improved this season. He's cut his strikeout rate by about 3%. He's improved his walk rate by about 5%. And just the amount of things that you're seeing him get better at, he's helping this team in so many different ways. I mean, I was listening to the radio broadcast earlier today, and to hear Charlie and Dave bring up, like, the way that he is helping this team. 15 homers already, 10 stolen bags. He has an on-base of .414. And I know the numbers for the analytics on him aren't very friendly to him as a fielder. Baseball Savant has him as just a fourth percentile fielder, which is actually worse than last season where he was 14th percent. But that doesn't match the eye test, and sometimes the, I think over a large sample size, generally those metrics play out and they can give you a good idea, but sometimes those metrics over a year sample size, or especially a third of a year sample size, aren't always going to give you exactly what your eyes are seeing. And I can tell you this, from watching James Wood play on a night-in, night-out basis, he looks like a much better fielder this season. And to see the way that he's grown on his outfield defense, he's already robbed. It's got to be four homers or more. He robbed a home run today of Travis Pizzana. He robbed Juan Soto of a homer when they were in New York. And that one was fun to watch because you've seen him now just reach up above the wall casually, like the one today against Travis Pizzana. Seen that him do that a bunch of times. Being as tall as he is, with as long of arms as he is, at times it just looks like he's just grabbing something off the top shelf, like he's in the grocery store or at home grabbing, you know, cereal or something like that. It's incredible to watch him do that. But the one against Juan Soto at Citi Field, that was gone by a pretty significant margin, and he got to the wall early and just jumped straight up in the air and grabbed it. And to see his improvement as a fielder, he's made some incredible plays diving. He's really improved defensively. And I think part of that is he's been more comfortable in right field. And so him being able to move around the outfield a little bit, but playing more right field this season, I think you're seeing him be more comfortable in the outfield. And I think that actually fits their outfield configuration better. I think Lyle, you've seen him take a massive step as a fielder this season. He's too athletic. He's too good of an athlete to not be a better fielder than he was last season. He challenged himself in that same sort of way, thinking that way too. Like, there's no way. I'm as fast and as athletic as I am, and I'm not able to be a better fielder. Now, I think that he could be better in terms of his arm, but for the most part, he's been a really good outfielder in left field for this team. And James, being in right field, having the stronger arm, I think that fits better, allowing Lyle to play in left with a little bit of a weaker arm compared to James. And obviously JY, Dylan Cruz, those guys, when they're playing, they'll play center field and help those guys play on the corners. But just to see the strides from James this season and the way that he plays the game, you don't want to take it for granted. And I hope that this is one of the guys that the Nationals can keep around, because I think it's cool to see a guy from here. I mean, he's from Rockville. He's from around here. His family's at the game all the time. He gets it. He's been from around here. And to see him succeed, play as well as he does, and be as humble as he is, it's really cool to have him as the leader of the Nationals. And you know, he's someone that's not super outspoken. He's not someone that's going to, you know, rah-rah. And that's why I think, you know, last season really taught me something in terms of team building, that it is important to have not just the right mix of talent, but the right mix of guys in a clubhouse, in a locker room, so that, you know, you have the rah-rah guy, but you also have the leaders who are quiet, they just go about their business. But to make sure that you have the right mix of personalities so that there's life in the clubhouse, but you've also got the guys that, you know, aren't all over the spectrum, so that they can at least keep a level head for the guys when the things are going tough. So I think that that's a big part of it. And James is someone that, you know, he could be 0 for 5 or with 5 strikeouts, or he could be 5 for 5 with 3 homers and 2 doubles. You wouldn't know. I mean, the way that he goes about his business is really impressive to see, his maturity. And I think this season, you've seen him take another step. And the thing that I love about watching James that makes him so unique, and I think it's funny seeing just some of the dialogue around him, is would he have more homers if he hit everything to the pull side? Probably. I mean, that's just general consensus thinking, right? That's generally what you would think, is if he pulled more balls in the air, that he would have more home runs. I'm sure he would. This season, his pull air percentage is down slightly, 11.3 last year, 10.9, which has actually jumped up quite a bit from what it had been earlier in the season. He was almost hitting exclusively to up the center, up the middle, and to left field. But what makes him so unique is his ability to drive baseballs the other way. We've seen plenty of guys throughout Major League history, and even in the game right now, that are able to hit absolute tanks to the pull side. I mean, you can go and find one almost on every single team, and even just left-handed hitters. You just think about Bryce Harper, what he can do to the pull side. You think about even less known names like a Nick Kurtz out in Sacramento, and what he's able to do when he's crushing baseballs. Corey Seager, or whatever it is. Take your pick of a slugger. We've seen plenty of guys that can hit absolute nukes to the pull side. What we don't see very often is guys like James who can drive the ball out the other way with the authority that he does. And so I'm sure as time goes on, he'll start pulling the ball more. That just naturally is going to happen, I think. But his gift is something that you shouldn't try to take away. His gift is his ability to drive the ball 440 plus feet the opposite way. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody can. There's very few people that can do what James Wood does in that regard. And so I don't think you should try to take that away from him. I think the big difference this season, why you've seen him be more successful, he's going to crush baseballs. There's no question about that. Just watch him swing. He's going to crush baseballs. It's just about whether he's going to be able to get the ball in the air or not. It's gone up. His air percentage has gone up about 10% this season. I don't think it's any coincidence that, in turn, you've seen James Wood become a absolute superstar for this team. When you're putting the ball in the air and you hit it as hard as he does, good things are going to happen. And I don't care if it's to left field, center field, or right field. When he is putting the ball in the air with the authority he hits with, it's going to do damage. All right, let's take a break. When we wrap up, we'll talk a little more Nats to wrap things up. You're listening to Overtime on The Fan. Final couple minutes of Overtime. Toby Altizer with you for about 10 more minutes. We'll finish the show with the same thing we started the show with. Let's talk a little more Nationals. We were just talking about James Wood, how impressive he's been. I'm excited to get out to the ballpark this weekend, start of a 6-game homestand for the Nationals. And it's funny looking at some of their opponents. One of the injuries that I meant to bring up with the strange injuries, the Nationals are slated to face Eury Pérez potentially for the Miami Marlins next Tuesday. In his start tonight, Chris, he apparently injured himself stretching in the dugouts.
That's weak.
I guess it was a right hamstring spasm. So I think he's okay. But
I mean, a spasm, who knows? That can be caused for whatever, I guess. But, like, come on. What did he join his girl doing yoga class and beat himself up? Like, what's going on?
He was in the dugout in between innings, and he was just literally doing a little bit of a stretch, and all of a sudden something grabbed on him.
Well, I wonder what kind of stretch it was. Jeez, man.
I mean, it was just a little dynamic stretch, nothing crazy. So, I mean, again, baseball injuries to me sometimes, like, you feel bad. You don't want the guys to ever get hurt, but sometimes baseball injuries are funny. And, I mean, feel bad for the guy. He's a good pitcher, so I think he'll be fine to make his start against the Nationals. Regardless, this homestand for the Nationals, I think, is going to be a fun one. You've got the Padres coming to town. I want to talk about them more in just a second because they're an interesting team in this. They're almost the opposite of the Nationals, where the Nationals, you're like, I thought they were supposed to be bad, and it feels like they're overachieving, and how are these offensive numbers so good? The Padres are like the exact opposite, but I want to talk about that in just a second. But this homestand is going to be fun. You got San Diego coming to town for three. Lucas Giolito, the former National who was traded away for Adam Eaton, the World Series champion in 2019, he's going to be pitching for San Diego. Then they got Michael King, Griffin Canning, and then you got the Miami Marlins in town for three. Sandy Alcantara, Yuri Perez, Max Meyer, three really good horses for Miami going for them. But back to San Diego. I'm excited to see Michael King pitch. He's one of my favorite pitchers in all of baseball, so that'll be fun to watch on Saturday. That'll be C.J. Abrams bobblehead day. I wonder if, I don't know if the Nationals did this on purpose or not, but C.J. Abrams bobblehead day? I don't know. C.J. Abrams, former Padres prospect, former Padre, brought over in the Juan Soto deal. I don't know if that's a little subtle shade or not. I don't know if it's just having a little bit of fun or if it's just a coincidence of timing. Regardless, C.J. Abrams, James Wood, I mean, every time we revisit that trade, it looks so genius. And it's something that Mike Rizzo really seemed to always be good at. You know, there were some misses, no question about it. You can look at the Max Scherzer, Trey Turner trade, and that wasn't a success, you would say, with Josiah Gray and K'Bert Ruiz. You would have hoped for more for, you know, the caliber of pitcher of Max Scherzer and the caliber of shortstop for a year and a half of Trey Turner. Regardless, you know, I think this Mackenzie Gore deal now for Paul Toboni looks like it could be a really, really good deal, and that was part of the Juan Soto deal, was getting Mackenzie Gore, C.J. Abrams, and James Wood. And, I mean, look at the top of this team right now, C.J. Abrams and James Wood, and you also got five more prospects for Gore. It's still crazy to see the amount of guys that are getting pumped through this team and really making meaningful impacts for this team just from that one trade from Juan Soto, which you should. When you trade a guy that is as good as Juan Soto, you better get something that we're talking about for years and years, and the Nationals fortunately did there. But I want to talk about the Padres here for a second. Like I mentioned with the Nationals, they feel like a team where you're like, all right, they weren't supposed to be very good. They're overachieving a little bit, and how in the world is the offense this good? The Padres are almost the exact opposite. They did have high expectations this season. Like, people expected the Padres to be good, but they're winning ball games. They're one of the better teams in the National League. They're third in their division. They're seven games over 500 and 31-24, and yet they cannot score runs. Like, coming into the series against the Nationals when they start the series on Friday night, the Nationals have scored 306 runs. The Padres have scored 214. Now, on the flip side, their pitching has been elite. The Padres have allowed 215 runs. The Nationals have allowed 310. So, it'll be fun to see the mix there. But I saw a stat today about the Padres. Dennis Lynn put it this way, and I think it's so true. The Padres might be the best bad team in baseball or the worst good team. They're the first club since the 1985 Mets to win at least 31 of their first 54 games with an OPS of 655 or lower. I mean, you look through their lineup, and they've got names still. They're a good baseball team on paper, and this is why I think you know, it's always fun to remind you. That's why you play the games. They're a good baseball team on paper. Fernando Tatis is still headlining their lineup. Jackson Merrill's still in their lineup. Manny Machado, like Xander Bogaerts. Yet Manny Machado is hitting 169 with a 603 OPS. Jackson Merrill's hitting 200 with a 589 OPS. And believe it or not, Fernando Tatis Jr. is going to come to D.C. without having hit a home run yet. I mean, how crazy is that? They've lost four in a row. They lost three to Philly, and they lost the series finale against the A's out in, or I guess they were at home against Sacramento. So they just got swept by the Phillies, so they're not coming in on their best foot. But I think that's funny to see where they're at, and almost the stark difference for the Nationals, where the Padres are still a good team who, for whatever reason, can't hit right now, and the Nationals weren't thought to be a good team at all, and yet they're hitting everything. It's a stark contrast to where they're at, but I think it just speaks to the fun that this team is. And you know, I think if you're the Nationals too, like looking at what the Padres have done, you'd love to be able to capture a little bit of what they've got going out there in San Diego. Because when you look at the way that they fill the ballpark on a night in, night out basis, that place is electric. And I know that there's no longer the Chargers there, and so really the Padres are the team in town, right? There's not a professional basketball team. Like it is the San Diego Padres that is the number one, so it's a little bit different. But if you're the Nationals, you'd love to find what that secret sauce is that they found in San Diego, that every single night they've got an electric ballpark. They're drawing really good crowds, not just against the Dodgers, not just against their, you know, division foes, not just against the big time opponents, but against everybody. It's a night in, night out basis where it's an electric atmosphere out there in San Diego. So if you could find something like that, because one of my favorite moments so far this season was just being in the ballpark for that Orioles series. And I know it's not all Nationals fans, but just seeing the ballpark full, having 38,000, 40,000 fans there at Nationals Park. I didn't get to experience 2019. I didn't get to experience any playoff games before that. I've never been in the yard for any of those. So the best moments that I've experienced at Nationals Park have not been playoff games. They've been, you know, games that are, you know, opening day or something like 4th of July game or something of that nature. And so seeing the ballpark get full for a game against the O's or against the Dodgers, and you know, you'd love it to be all Nats fans, but that's not always going to happen. But just the full atmosphere of a ballpark adds so much, and just the buzz of having people at the yard and just the ambient noise that you get, it adds so much to the ballpark. So I'm hoping for a good series against the Padres. Hopefully you can fill up the yard and have a lot of fun, because it's just better when there's a lot of people there. And I think Nats Park is a good park, and this is a fun team to get behind. It's one thing, again, I say this all the time now, and I sound like a broken record at this point, but the worst thing that you can be as a professional sports franchise is bad and boring. And luckily for this team, with where they're at right now, they're not bad, and they're definitely not boring. Even if you are bad, you better not be boring, right? And fortunately for this team, they're neither of those things right now. So hopefully, if you can, get out to the yard, watch this team Friday, Saturday, and Sunday against the Padres. Should be a fun series with the Friars coming to town. All right, that's going to do it for Overtime. Appreciate you listening in. Appreciate David Harrison for stopping by. If you missed any of the show, you can always go back and check it out on the podcast. Metal Chris been doing a great job behind the scenes, putting everything up. I think we had a really good talk about the linebackers, really good talk about the offense and some of the stuff from OTAs, and David Harrison was a fantastic interview as always. For Metal Chris, doing all the hard work back in the studio, I'm Toby Altizer. Thanks for listening. Appreciate you. Have a great night.